Hello there, and welcome to the episode number 14 of Dev Conversations by SwiftToolkit.dev, where we host developers that contribute to the Swift tooling and server ecosystem. For today, our guest is Antoine van der Lee, who you probably already know from Swiftly.com, and he's also the creator of RocketSim, a very popular and useful tool for iOS development. Hey, Antoine.
Hey, how's it going?
How's it going? Good, good. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, exciting to see where we can go to talk about anything.
Yeah. As I do with all guests, tell me a little bit about your beginnings with programming.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, you introduced me already a bit on where people know me from now, but funny enough, you know, I do quite a lot of things, right? Swiftly, RocketSim, and so on, and I often got asked, like, how do you do all those things? Especially back in the days when I was still working full-time at WeTransfer, like, how do you do it? You have a full-time job. And then eventually I had a kid. How do you do it? You have a full-time job, and you have a kid, and a dog, and chickens, and you do all these things. But yeah, it's something I build up over time. I'm quite structured. I'm the type of person that when he does, like, bouldering and I go for a route, I would stick to that single route all evening until I finish it. And I wouldn't skip anything until I made it till the end. And that's a bit my path of my career journey as well, right? So my first website was when I was 30 and I was playing a video game and I created like an HTML website for it with a TK domain. And then I continued and I built like Flash advertisements for some kind of agency with ActionScript, and then eventually HTML with CSS became more and more prominent. So you start doing that. And I wrote a little bit PHP, wrote my own CMS as one does. Why would you use something that's already available, right? And that continued and continued until I got an offer to work on Windows Phone, which was a thing. I'm not sure if it still exists, actually. But yeah, I was like, yeah, sure. I want to build apps. I want to build something for an actual phone. That would be amazing. And then my neighbor, colleague, developer was working for iOS. And when I saw that, you know, I couldn't afford an iPhone back in the days. But that's where the real dream kind of started.
Yeah. Also, the first thing I learned to program was also ActionScript and Flash. And a few iOS developers also that I know also learned Flash back in the day.
Those were the days.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about WeTransfer, any interesting open source projects you might have done?
Yeah.
Or any big challenges you had there?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's funny enough, when I was working at an agency that was before WeTransfer, I started as a junior, I became a mid-year, senior, team lead, and at a certain point, I was in my bubble and I believed, like, okay, there's not much more I can learn or something like that, right? I wasn't really challenged. And at an agency, when you become like a senior, you often get projects that you do solely. So I wasn't really working together with anyone, no pull request reviews and all those kind of things. And then I started working at WeTransfer, where I joined a team of, well, actually one internally iOS engineer and two like externals that worked for Uber and Sketchcloud before, quite you know, high level. And that's when I started to learn where I was actually at with my skills, which was nothing close to what I thought it was. So the PRs didn't get approved. I used third-party libraries for anything, didn't get approved, you know. So in a way, I really thought I went a step up, but feeling-wise, I went three steps back or something like that. But yeah, that was quite a journey. I worked 7.5 years at WeTransfer until I went indie in 2024. And over those 7 years, we basically started with nothing. We had an app that was built by an agency, which was put out of the App Store because the quality was so low. And then we decided to rebuild, but not the WeTransfer app, but first the Collect app, which was kind of like a new product that we put in place. But building that up from the ground, you know, like I knew every piece of code, or at least I reviewed it in a PR or wrote it myself, for such a high scale, because the website was already serving like millions, like 80, 90 millions of users back in the days. So you put an app against it and you immediately receive a lot of traffic, right? So that was quite a, you had that Fabric. Do you know Fabric?
Before crash Linux, no?
So
you could see the real time.
Yeah, the blue dot. We had it on a screen in the office. That was amazing to watch. But yeah, that was back in the days. But the best thing is when you just get started, you build a lot of libraries yourself, and we transformed really into like open sourcing. Or let's put it this way: we were really into open sourcing, and we transformed was willing to, you know, be open to do that in a way. also because we thought it would attract new engineers, it would put us into the world.
It's engineering brand.
Yeah, engineering brand, exactly. And it paid itself back eventually, so that was actually true. But yeah, it's in hindsight a sad story, because 2 years ago we Transfer got acquired, and that resulted in a lot of layoffs. And it was actually last year, correct me there, but that also meant like the original owners of those repositories are now kind of like left the company. But fortunately enough, they still exist. They're not put offline. And I think two really stand out for me. One is Mocker. Mocker is something we've built to mock HTTP requests from URL session, but in such way that you don't change anything to your code. You basically use URL session. You configure a URL protocol, and it basically intercepts all the requests, and it returns the JSON that you configured. And it allowed us to really, you know, easily mock a certain request response without really injecting any code or, you know, using protocols or anything like that. So that's one. And the other one is Diagnostics, which is truly my little baby in a way. I'm still using it for RocketSim and all the other apps that I built. And it is a way for users to report an issue. But with that report, which is an email report, with that email, an HTML report gets added. It's basically an HTML file with a little bit of JavaScript, and it shows all the sessions the user had. And for me as a developer, I can see all the system logs, all the debug logs that I would normally have during development. I have a few ways to filter them out to only see the errors, for example. But I also see like, hey, which version got installed? Which OS version is running? All those common questions that you would normally ask before even diving into an issue. That was quite game-changing at WeTransfer as well. The whole support team knew how they work.
They could use that. Nice.
Yeah. So the number of times they reached out to an engineer for a question lowered quite a bit, because we created like smart insights. We parsed the logs. And whenever you encounter a certain string in those logs, you would say like, hey, this is smart insight. The user had this error, which is known, and we're working on it. So the support agent could read that in the HTML file and directly reply to the user. And that's still working today, which is super, super helpful.
Nice. Very nice. And we spoke a little bit about Swiftly already. When did you start? When you had the idea to, hey, I think I can share my knowledge with other developers, and what were your goals?
Yeah, I always said to myself, like, I'm writing for myself and the others can benefit. That's their win. But there's no pressure for me to put out any quality because I'm writing for myself. And that was really lowering the barrier for me in the beginning to just write articles, publish them quickly when I felt good about it. I figured, okay, this is worth publishing out. And I'm still using the personal base myself. I'm often finding my own articles. So sometimes it's even surprising that I'm searching on Google and I'm like, oh, I wrote about it 2 years ago.
It happened to me this week. I needed help with something. And
yeah,
on server side stuff I searched my own blog. Yeah.
It's the best thing, isn't it? You know how you solved it the other day, so you can easily use that again. But I started the blog, I think it was 2015 officially. Didn't do much with it, 2016, 2017. And in 2017, I joined WeTransfer. And that was also a moment where I thought, like, okay, I wanna speak at conferences more. But even though I now worked at what I thought was a known company, I didn't really get any accepted proposals. It was really hard to get in. And, you know, I didn't have kids. I was single. I was like, I want to go to all those cities, get paid for the flight at least and stuff. and have fun, right? Like that was the dream. But yeah, I couldn't get accepted. And at the same time, I saw many similar names at all the conferences. So I concluded like, okay, they are known names. And it makes sense, right? If the conference gets known names, they sell more tickets. So there's always a few spots at those conferences that will be assigned to the thought leaders in the community. So I might as well become a thought leader. That's what I thought. So that's when I started writing an article every week, consistency. And I still do that. So ever since 2017, every single Tuesday, I send out a new article. And that really ramped up. I gained more followers. I gained more reach. I became a more known name. And eventually, that even resulted in conferences asking me to give a talk rather than me sending a proposal.
Applying.
Right? So yeah. And this is now heavily focused on just conference talks, but it gave me so much more, right? Like I already told you before that I went indie. I would have never gone indie if I didn't start blogging back in the days, right? It resulted in a newsletter, resulted in sponsorships, it resulted in reach for Rocket Sim, which is a developer tool for iOS engineers.
Yeah. So you can have a channel of marketing of yourself. Yeah.
Exactly. My whole business basically is now built around the audience that I've started building in 2017.
Yeah. And you said consistency. That's, for me at least, the hardest thing with kids and a full-time job, finding subjects, right? You sometimes you maybe don't have a subject ready, or that's definitely it. So I have a wish list of posts. I don't know how you manage that.
But this is often the difference between one that really wants to write consistently but fails, or one that really wants to write consistently but succeeds. You need to have a structure and a technique. And what I used to do, and I don't really do it anymore, but I used to create like a Trello board with all the ideas that I had to write about. I also look at like, what am I building this week? What is high up in my mind in terms of context? Is that something I can turn into an article? Because writing such articles is super easy. You're already in that context. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I also look at, you know, like search engine insights, like what are popular keywords.
What are people looking for?
Yeah, exactly. And then still, you know, I'm trying to pick the ones that speak to me as well in terms of interest, right? I don't want to necessarily write about Swift UI animations because it's just not my best skill nowadays, right? But if I see something about concurrency, which I'm really a big fan of, you know, like if I find a keyword that I don't rank for, that would be one of the things to consider, right? So that is kind of like a way to do it. And it's also structured in terms of like, when do you write the article? For me, it's always on a Tuesday morning. I block time to write an article, and there must be a super important meeting or reason to not do it on Tuesday morning. And I did that back in the days when I was working at WeTransfer. I do that still. Now I have the whole week as an indie to do it, basically. But I still keep that structure because if you step out of your structure, it kind of breaks
then
your whole paradigm.
It's hard to get back.
Right?
Yes.
Exactly.
I was right now, like 2-3 weeks ago, I went on vacation. I went for a week to the US and I didn't publish like two weeks because it was so hard for me to get back. Yeah. And I skipped it. I was like for a year, four posts a month, and was hard getting back to the routine.
Yeah, I mean, I go on holiday too. And yeah, my wife, my family kind of knows that this is my business, right? So I still, even on a holiday, I write my articles on Tuesday morning. But what I do is instead of writing a whole new article, which takes a lot more time.
You already plan ahead.
What I now do, I pick an article that I already wrote, but it's so outdated. And instead of like having to rewrite it completely, I just have to focus on like, okay, how can I rewrite it to be back up to date in a more modern way of writing, so to say. And that often leads to enough new visitors as well. And it feels like still a new article for that week, right? Once again, I'm writing for myself in a way.
Yeah, and not only that, the Antoine of today is different from the Antoine of 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Yeah, and Swift and Swift UI today is different too.
Yes.
That's
true. And what about tooling? How is the website built? And do you have any specific tools you built around it?
Yeah. So I try to stay away from the rabbit hole, which is called
write your own blog generators. Engine.
Yeah. You know, like whenever I can save time anywhere, I try to do that. And WordPress is what I'm using. It's serving, I think, 35% of all websites on the web. It's so big. There's a plugin for everything. And eventually I got sponsors so I could invest in stuff. So I've invested in premium plugins. I still statically serve the website via Cloudflare, which makes it as fast as most of the static websites as well. You know, it allows me to focus on what I want to do, is writing articles. I don't want to focus on creating a website completely from beginning to end, having to find out how SEO works, because I have built the website myself. I just install Yoast SEO, for example, or any other plugin, and it does it all for me. It maybe asks me a few things, but you want to optimize as much as possible and buy yourself back time to actually build things that have impact.
Yeah. Awesome. And the reason you are here in this podcast in the other day is because of Rocket Sim, because of the tooling around iOS. Tell me a little bit how it began. We'll talk about nerdy stuff later, but how the idea was born. And there's also Control Room, an open source version of something similar. How do you market your own?
Yeah, absolutely. So Rocket Sim started in 2019. I was working at WeTransfer, and we had many different file transfers that we had to test every time. And I created like an HTML page with a simple unordered list with all those links of transfers that would be universal links opening the simulator, so I could test that during development. But, you know, you open a different simulator, you don't have that HTML link in your history of Safari, you need to type it yourself, open it in Safari, click the link, you know, it's repetitive, it's slow, it didn't really work out. So that's when I figured, okay, there's a tool that Apple provides, which is called Sim Control. It's a terminal command line tool, and there was an action to open deep links. So I might as well just create my first Mac app and see how Mac development works, which was fun, and create a little debug or a deep link executor, so to say. And that was the first version of Rocket Sim, which was a simple status bar app. And you're absolutely right. There are many open source tools like this available, but still, it was fun to build, right? I figured, I think I could even use an open source tool back in the days for this as well. But then I continued, and I didn't build it to make money. I built it to become more productive, and I built it to make other developers more productive, right? So the first 1-2 years, I didn't make any money with it either. I think lifetime was like $10 or something. I still had lifetime back in the days. I don't have it anymore. But just to draw a picture, because today it's super successful in that sense. But the main goal was still there, you know, finding things that are cumbersome today and make it more easy to use to do as an iOS engineer. And that compounded in many, many more features. And today, Rocket Sim offers about 30 plus utilities for the simulator, including what many others, there are many features that no competitors offer. Yeah. And
you did recently camera, right? Camera support.
Yeah. So the funny thing is with Rocket Sim, I started in 2019, and some features I already had in mind in 2019, but I had no clue how to build it. And this is a bit of nerdy stuff already, I think, but you start to dive deeper and deeper into the whole world of simulators, right? I even had a chance to talk with the developers at Apple
to
work on the simulator. Nice. Yeah, the engineers. And they gave me some internal insights as well. And you build up some knowledge that isn't necessarily available online, and ChatGPT or any other AI tool can tell you it either, right? It's really like a certain niche piece of knowledge that you build up over time. And that allowed me to really build features that are based on the internals, that allowed me to create like a network speed control, which allows you to slow down the network for just your app. Your max connectivity remains fast. So it's like a network link conditioner for the simulator. But also, indeed, the camera on the simulator doesn't work, right? It simply opens a black screen. Sometimes it doesn't do even anything. And I thought that's so stupid. Like, why didn't Apple build this for us? And then I thought, like, what? what if I can stream the Mac camera and use that as an input for the iOS camera? And I finally, after years, figured out how to do it. And it's now so, it works a little too good. Problem is that the simulator actually thinks there's a hardware device connected. So it tries to connect with that hardware device. And there's like a delay of 5 seconds and then it times out. And that's when the camera starts working on the simulator. So I had to swizzle the start running on AV capture session and let that run on a background thread instead of being a blocking thread, a call, to make it feel like it's still instant in a way. And that really leads to a pretty solid feature. And I can't mention names, but one of the largest camera apps tried it out and is even considering it now. That's how good it works for teams with a camera. Think about it. If you have an app that's mainly focused on camera functionality and you always have to test on an actual device, but now you can use the simulator and potentially in the nearby feature, it's a game changer, right? In terms of productivity. And in the nearby feature, we want to allow you to create pre-recorded videos and stream those to the simulator. So if you have some kind of like Core ML feature where you want to recognize something in a certain video, you can go outside, film that car, for example, use that for development constantly when you build that feature to recognize the correct car. I don't know, thinking about something, but mm-hmm. It's features like these that make Rocket Sim unique, that makes developers renew their licenses every year. It is paid for some part, and that's just because I'm an indie developer, I need to pay the bills. But it's also, you know, it allows me to really spend much time in it and make it even better than it is today.
Yeah, you could also maybe, if you're ready, do that mocking of video and camera video stream. You could also, I don't know, maybe also offer tools for testing. I don't know, make also testing easier.
Yeah, one of the requests I often get is like command line interface or maybe even shortcuts integration or MCP, right? Like that you can imagine like the network request, right? When I offer that data to AI and you have a certain bug in your app, you could ask AI, like, these are the requests that Rocket Sim captured. Can you look into the responses and see what's wrong? You know, that is like the next level simulator development, so to say. But I have like tens of big major features that I could build, and I'm constantly picking the ones that I think, okay, you know, high impact, low effort, yeah, kind of. That's what I'm looking for.
And do you have any interesting stories about maybe technical challenges or features that were hard for you to get them done?
Yeah, so the ones I mentioned, right, like the network speed control, I had that in mind forever because I knew the network link conditioner, but I had no clue how to build it. I eventually found out, and it took me like a day to actually build it. So it was really like the whole route towards finding out how it works. Several chats at WWDC, posts in Apple forums, going deep into the kernel to see how Charles Proxy works, basically building up knowledge until you find it. But I think the funniest story is about a simulated camera where I went debugging on an actual device. I started logging private API methods to gain more insights into how the whole AV capture session logic works, run into issues, private header files on GitHub. There are some repositories that make them for each OS version. Yeah. Find out about new private APIs, so on and so on. Had a proof of concept, went to WWDC, went to talk with the engineers that work on the framework, press them by with a proof of concept, ask them like, hey, how does this work internally? Well, if you have been at WWDC, you know, many engineers don't tell you anything. So you basically get like little pieces of insights that you need to use to put things together.
Assemble and things. Once, yeah, it's a puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. And once again, you can search for like how to build a macOS streaming for the simulated camera on Google, but nobody built it, right? So you're reinventing something. You can't really rely on anything there. There's no open source example. So that is a bit the general story with Rocket Sim. For sure, there are many open source alternatives that basically build a UI around SimCTL. But the features that Rocket Sim truly made a success...
That's the big differentiator for it, yeah.
Yeah, the features that I've built that aren't available in open source are the reason that many people come back to RocketSim and why it's so successful for me today.
And how to tackle marketing? Because as a developer, all right, you know how to build an app, but
yeah,
but you're not a person that, or at least you weren't before you started on it.
No, I'm not the best marketer. I can tell that right away. I think I'm just super lucky to, or it's not only luck, right? Like what I did, I built an audience and I sticked to that single audience. So I'm not creating like a soccer app, a camera app, and another social media app where I have to build an audience three times, right? I have a single audience. And if I improve my newsletter, gain more subscribers, it's likely that I also gain more RocketSim subscribers because they eventually find out that I built RocketSim. So the majority of new users come from either Swiftly Weekly, or one of my social media channels. There's also developer relationship managers at Apple, going to WWDC, hanging out in the community, going to conferences, all those kind of things help out there. And I think it's very likely your audience aren't developers if you're listening to this. But I think the key takeaway there is to, you know, invest in more places where your audience exists, right? See if you can start a newsletter for your target audience. See if you can work together with influencers that might be targeting your audience, right? Like, see if you can get yourself an Antoine in a way. And that works. But at the same time, we can clearly tell RocketSim as product market fit, right? Like the majority of teams that start using it, continue using it, renew, buy more seats. But getting yourself into a new team, finding them, paid acquisition is something I still didn't succeed in, which is quite surprising if you think about it. If you consider that, you know, the LTV per user is quite high, the churn is low, so there must be a success path there. And that's actually where the biggest challenge for us lies now. It's easy to become lazy as well because there's organic growth, but at the same time, I feel like the true growth lies in, you know, getting more users via paid acquisition and via marketing. Yeah. So, yeah, if you're listening and you have the golden tips for me, but yeah, that's still something we're trying to figure out in a nice way.
All right. And to wrap up, I'm going to ask us about a subject that for now it's the episode with most views and listens, was with Matt Massicott. We spoke about Swift concurrency. So what would be your tips for someone who's struggling with concurrency or someone who feels still behind? Besides learning the default documentation by Apple or...
Yeah. Well, this is a proof that I'm bad in marketing, right? I didn't even mention that I have a course on Swift concurrency.
That wasn't planned. Honestly, yeah. Wasn't planned. I think that as I was asking, I remember that, but it's relatively new, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that once again, I have the audience and I figured building courses is in line with writing articles. So why not create a course on something I like like a lot? And I look up to Matt in many ways. Matt is a great, I think he gives workshops, but he's super knowledgeable in this space. And
yeah.
I learn a lot from him. So shout out to you, Matt. Thanks a lot for all the content you put out. So that would be one of the first things to say, like, make sure you follow his articles, which you can do by subscribing to his blog or subscribing to my newsletter. I often mention them there too. In general, the WWDC videos of this year are super great in telling what's new in Swift 6.2. And I wouldn't even look back into before Swift 6.2 because there are so many groundbreaking changes that make concurrency much more approachable. It's not an easy answer to give right away, right? Concurrency is a big thing. It's not easy to wrap your head around. It's doable to use AI for it. AI is not up to date with the latest Swift 6.2 changes. As far as I know, it learns and it gets better, but then still, I would say really make sure you understand what it's doing. It's a new way of thinking. There's a new way of looking at threading, you know, how to do concurrent programming with Swift changed. So even though AI, Xcode with integrated AI can help you forward, the refactoring tools become better, you still need to be aware of what exists and is the code that's being written for me actually correct code, right? So invest in your knowledge, look at the WWDC videos. I would say look at my course. I think it's valuable too. It has 65 lessons right now, and I'm still adding new ones. But there's many great free articles out there too that you can look at. And yeah, make sure to use it. If you start a new package today, start a new project today, make sure it's 6.2 from the get-go. Yeah. That forces you to really get used to it, and it makes the tech debt, you know, it doesn't grow your tech debt, so to say. So that would be my tips.
Yeah. One, if I can add my own, is if you have an app that is very modularized, you can start making the lower frameworks supporting strict concurrency. And then it's easier to do when you have different smaller pieces and do piece by piece. And then you, as when you finish a layer, you go to the upper one and the upper one. If you have an app with that's a single target, it's much harder. So try to break things apart and build from there.
Yeah, I created a migration module in my course, and I have like migration habits, so to say. And one of the tips I give is like what you mentioned, right? Like find an isolated part, ideally a package without any dependencies. Because if you have a package with dependencies and you update it to Swift 6.2, maybe add more async await methods to it, all the dependencies need to work with that new isolation as well. You might need to add actor isolation in many different places. Whereas if you have an isolated package that nobody really depends on, that could simplify the migration part and get yourself up and running with the new knowledge, right? And then on top of that, there's migration tooling that works great for packages as well. And it allows you to opt in, like the non-isolated, non-sending is new as Swift 6.2. Quite an important change. You don't want to do that all manually. In fact, if you do it manually, you could introduce new threading behavior, which could break your code. So if you let the migration tooling do it for you, that could result in much better code. So definitely great tip to find that isolation.
All right, Antoine, we'll finish here. Thank you so much for your insights, for your stories. And if people want to find you online, they probably know, right? Swiftly.com.
I hope they already know where to find me.
Yeah.
If not, it's actually not swiftly.com. I wish I had that domain. It's avendely.com. But Swiftly, if you search for it on Google, I'm sure you'll find me.
Yeah, it's the first. Yeah,
it must be. Otherwise, I'm doing the marketing game wrong again. Other than that, from there, you'll find my newsletter. RocketSim is rocketsim.app, and all the social links, I'm sure you'll find them in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll leave notes also for the course, right? And
sounds good.
And I'll catch you on the next one.
Sounds good. Thanks for inviting me over.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.